Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, the river of grass, dying of thirst. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Kate Stein. Water flows slowly through the Everglades. It always has, but in today's Everglades, with its dikes, levees, and canals, water seeps through the system directed not by Mother Nature as much as by human intervention.
The lingering nature of water through the Everglades has been matched by the slow progress toward the massive goal of reviving the region with more water and cleaner water. It's been 17 years now since President Bill Clinton signed into law the bill that included the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. It began the modern-day effort to fix the Everglades after a century of draining and redirecting the water to create today's South Florida.
This is a very happy day for the Everglades and is a signal day for the movement of the world to try to repair damaged environmental systems.
That's Florida Democratic Senator Bob Graham on the day in December 2000 when the plan to fix the Everglades was signed into law.
There has never been an effort of the scale or complexity that is now underway to save a dying environmental system as we are doing with America's Everglades.
Now, among the crowd that day on the White House driveway was Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and he knew the following years would not be easy to restore the Everglades.
The hard work is to work with the Army Corps and Department of Interior to implement this plan. It's very complex. It's exciting to be part of this because over the next 20 years, we will accomplish something that, as Senator Graham said, will be a model, I think, for the rest of the world.
More than halfway through the expected time frame for the work, estimated to cost in the billions of dollars, and only a half dozen projects are underway.
Projects have happened, like restoring some of the twists and turns in the Kissimmee River that feeds Lake Okeechobee, and shoring sections of the Hoover Dike, which holds back Lake O from South Florida. It's just that funding, politics, and economic interests have held back progress towards restoring more water flow through the system. Florida Senate President Joe Negron hopes to change that this year. He wants lawmakers to approve spending about $100 million a year over the next 20 years to buy land and build a reservoir to store water south of Lake Okeechobee. That southern storage is in the original Everglades plan, but planning is scheduled to begin in 2021. Negron doesn't want to wait any longer.
I keep hearing people talk about let's do something in 2021 or 2025. That's not acceptable to me or my community or to Southwest Florida. You know, we're not just going to study things and wait and expect people to endure this havoc wreaked on their communities.
The havoc Negron is talking about is the toxic green algae. Now, that formed last summer on the east coast of Florida when the fresh water of Lake Okeechobee poured out through the St. Lucie Canal in the effort to bring down the lake's water level. The polluted water flowed through the canal, fueling an algae bloom, fouling waterways, marinas, and beaches. This is how Jill Roberts with our sister station WQCS in Fort Pierce described it to us last July.
The algae that's coming in has sort of a blue-green color. And at some places, it's kind of like a film on the top of the water. You can see it. But in other places, it's almost like a foam and almost hard. People who work around this say they've had some eye irritation, some sore throats and scratchy throats when they go home.
That was last summer. Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency in three counties, including Palm Beach County. A study conducted less than a month after the worst of the algae found 7 of 10 tourists planning a trip to Florida would avoid the area. The Negron plan aims to buy 60,000 acres of land south of Lake Okeechobee to store water on it. But U.S. Sugar, which had a deal to sell thousands of acres to the state a decade ago, says there's no need to buy land. This is spokeswoman Judy Sanchez.
Storage south of the lake is part of ongoing restoration, and it's part of future projects that are already part of the planning process. But there is no need to acquire more land for that because the land has already been acquired.
This is the latest chapter in the long-running debate over addressing the Everglades and the economic implications of any work towards restoring the system that feeds a multi-billion dollar agriculture industry, ecotourism, and supplies drinking water for all of South Florida, 8 million people.
Yeah, we are approaching the entrance.
Wayne Rassner is carrying a huge backpack and using a walking stick to make his way through knee-high muck. He's a guide at Everglades National Park and board chair of the South Florida National Parks Trust. Rassner takes a few more steps, and the muck is gone.
And look at the water, how clear that is. You'll see if that were in a glass, it would look the same as a glass of drinking water because of natural filtration.
The Everglades are an ecosystem that starts at the headwaters near Orlando and goes all the way down into Florida Bay, off the southern tip of Florida. The Everglades used to be like a really, really slow river. They kept the land pretty wet all year long and gave vital fresh water to sawgrass on land and seagrass in the bay. The water flowed north to south, but today a lot of it runs east and west from Lake Okeechobee at the ecosystem center. And that's caused two problems for Floridians and our water.
New at 6, growing concerns about toxic green algae.
It's a growing threat to the marine and tourism economy.
State of emergency in 4 counties.
The first problem is that guacamole-thick blue-green algae that coated parts of Florida's coasts last summer. It hurt tourism and fishing in communities like Stewart, where Florida Senate President Joe Negron lives. He's trying to fix one of the main causes.
Flooding southeast and southwest Florida with billions of gallons of polluted water from Lake Okeechobee.
The water in Lake Okeechobee has unnaturally high levels of phosphorus. It got into the lake as fertilizer and manure from fields and farms. When the water in the lake gets too high, the extra water is sent east and west. It mixes with more fertilizer from lawns and bacteria from really old septic systems. All that makes algae blooms grow really fast. Negron wants to speed up planning to build a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Because if you can send the water south, it won't go east and west.
We're wasting billions of gallons of water in sort of two funnels.
Julie Hill Gabriel is with Audubon Florida. She agrees with Negron that the water should be sent south, which maybe seems kind of odd. Why would an environmentalist want fertilizer-heavy water seeping into the Everglades?
You know, the crux of Everglades restoration is trying to replace the flow of water north to south that made the River of Grass so unique and such a natural treasure.
Remember, there were two problems. The second, the one that causes a bunch of other problems, is water flow, or lack of water flow.
In the Everglades, we've built hundreds of miles of canals and levees, held water too high in some places, drained it from other places in order to allow agriculture and development to occur.
Now, water just doesn't flow south like it used to, which means Everglades National Park and the seagrass in Florida Bay are getting dehydrated. It's bad for tourism, bad for fishing, and
the water. All about the water.
Wayne Rassner, the Everglades National Park guide. He's sloshing toward an alligator hole in a dome of cypress trees and explaining how a lack of fresh water in the Everglades is bad news for the 8 million of us who get drinking water from the aquifer underneath.
Right, so the importance of keeping enough water above it is twofold. One is that that water seeps down into it.
Into the marshy soil, which acts as a natural filter and gives the aquifer more fresh water. The other reason the Everglades needs a steady flow of fresh water? Sea level rise.
It puts pressure against the salt water, which is trying to intrude. Once there's salt water intrusion into an aquifer, you've lost it.
The salt water has already begun pushing its way into the aquifer. And half of the original Everglades ecosystem has been lost to development, agriculture, and other human activity. Consider that the next time you turn on your tap for a drink.
Still to come on the program, the push this spring to spend money on storing water.
When there's a front page article on the national section of the New York Times showing our community floating with green algae, people don't say, oh, I shouldn't go to the general area between Vero Beach and West Palm Beach, and I shouldn't go to Sanibel or Fort Myers. They go, oh, I didn't know they were polluting their water in Florida.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, the river of grass dying of thirst. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Kate Stein. Today marks the beginning of the second week of the 60-day regular legislative session for Florida lawmakers. A priority for the top Republican in the Senate is to find more than $1 billion over the next 20 years to buy land for a massive reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee.
This is an effort to store and clean water before it gets to the Everglades system, or has to be flushed out to the west and east coasts and risk an algae bloom like we saw last summer, hurting property values and the tourist business.
Lawmakers are considering a couple of bills that could impact restoration, including one that was expanded last week beyond buying land to building a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Republican Senator Rob Bradley from North Florida led the effort to include other water projects throughout the state.
Basically, we need to have clean water for our families and our businesses, sufficient water to grow food, and we need to preserve our rivers, our springs, and our natural systems for future generations. And it's not just in Lake Okeechobee.
Now, this bigger, expanded bill would pay the tab for projects like sewage collection in the Keys and switching from septic systems to sewer systems in other communities. It would pay for it with borrowed money by shifting bonding capacity from an existing conservation program to this one. The bill passed out of subcommittee with a 5-1 vote. Democrat Oscar Brainin from Miami Gardens voted against it over worries about job losses if agricultural land is used instead for water storage.
Nobody wants to see a fisherman lose his job. Nobody wants to see a farm worker who picks sweet corn losing their job. None of that has to happen.
The Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on the Environment and Natural Resources vote is just the first step in the long process the bill faces this spring. Coming up, we'll talk with a big opponent of this latest plan, U.S. Sugar. But first, what does it mean to work to restore the Everglades? Let's start with what we're losing. One of the most biologically diverse places on Earth, from sawgrass to cypress trees, apple snails to alligators. The historic home of Florida's Miccosukee and Seminole tribes. The ecosystem that ensures fresh drinking water for more than 8 million Floridians. A national park. Everglades advocate Marjorie Stoneman Douglas talked about all this in an interview in 1983.
It was a marvelous expanse of flat green land with its strangeness and its openness and its birds. It's utterly unique, you see. There's not like anything else like it in the world.
More than 30 years later, Wayne Rassner is standing in a pool of water inside a cypress dome in Everglades National Park. He's a volunteer guide and the board chair of the South Florida National Parks Trust.
We don't have a giant waterfall or an enormous canyon or snow-covered mountains. We have a very subtle beauty.
To get here, Rassner drove several miles from the visitor center and walked into the swamp. Even out here, the sound of cars and planes is inescapable.
We've lost 50% of the ecosystem that we're not going to get back.
Mostly because of development, says Steve Davis. He's an ecologist with the Everglades Foundation. The Everglades freshwater aquifer is under siege from sea level rise. Parts of the ecosystem are flooded, others are so dry they're dying off. And massive water releases from Lake Okeechobee cause toxic algae blooms that throttle tourism and fishing on Florida's coasts. It wasn't supposed to get like this, ever, but especially since the year 2000. That was when President Bill Clinton and Florida Governor Jeb Bush signed a massive restoration plan. It's called the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, or CERP, and it was supposed to be finished in the mid-2030s.
But at this pace, it's going to take a half century or more to finish.
Davis jumps from an airboat into a water conservation area near Tamiami Trail. In thigh-deep water, he grabs a slimy glob of periphyton, a freshwater mix of algae and other gunky particles.
It's one of our best indicators of water quality. When phosphorus levels get above about 10 parts per billion, which is the protective threshold we know for the Everglades, this periphyton will start to really break apart to the point where you don't find it anymore.
One of the goals of the restoration plan is to remove excess phosphorus. It's mostly from runoff, fertilizer from sugar fields and farms, lawns, and also sewage. Incredible. Davis says cleaning the water is going well here, thanks in part to large man-made wetlands called stormwater treatment areas. There are six just below Lake Okeechobee. They clean the water as it flows slowly south, just like the natural Everglades once did.
With restoration, some would think that there's less of the hand of man involved with the management of the system. That's not going to be the case.
He says this is the only way to both help the Everglades resume its natural flow and ensure fresh water and flood control for millions of people. You can't just kick people out of Pahokee and Belglade, tear down the Herbert Hoover Dike, and let the water take back the land.
That's not, you know, we would certainly not advocate for, and the Corps of Engineers would never allow to happen after Hurricane Katrina.
Davis says even in the best case scenario, the restoration plan's impact might be hard to notice. A wetter dry season, more birds like roseate spoonbills and snail kites, healthier seagrass in Florida Bay. The Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan came out 17 years ago. It was supposed to be halfway done by now. But of its 68 planned projects, 6 are underway. None, 0, are complete.
The issue of water storage likely would not be in front of state lawmakers if not for Joe Negron. He's a Republican from Stewart, the community at the center of last summer's algae outbreak. Environmental groups hailed his proposal as a major breakthrough for Everglades restoration. When he announced his plan in early August, he called it his number one personal priority.
And I spoke to Negron before the legislative session began.
I was born at Good Samaritan Hospital in West Palm Beach, which is near the water in downtown West Palm Beach. I've lived in Palm Beach and Martin counties my entire life other than going away to college. And I have never seen the ocean close down in Martin County because of environmental damage. So for people that are saying we're on track, we're not on track, we're off track. What we're doing is not working. I'm not going to continue doing things and not taking additional steps when the current status quo is resulting in things getting worse and worse and destroying oyster beds and destroying seagrasses and doing things to our environment that if we did them as private citizens, we'd be arrested on federal charges.
Negron's solution aims to step up the timetable for creating a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. That's by spending $2.4 billion to buy 60,000 acres of land. Half of that money would come from the state, and the land could come from new sellers or from the state exercising its option to buy more land from U.S. Sugar. The option is left over from the deal a decade ago forged between the state and U.S. Sugar for the state to buy the company and its thousands of acres of land. That original deal didn't happen, and the state has purchased just a fraction of the U.S. Sugar land in the original agreement. But an option on the remaining 153,000 acres remains. U.S. Sugar contends it's an all-or-nothing option. Buy 153,000 acres or none of it. But Negron doesn't see it that way.
I think there's a legal option that gives the state an opportunity to secure land that there is a scientific consensus that's developed over the past 20 years that an indispensable component of reducing and hopefully eventually eliminating the discharges from Lake Okeechobee would require additional southern storage. This is not a novel idea. This is not a radical idea. This is something that's been goes back to when Jeb Bush was governor of Florida. So I think it makes perfect sense for the state to have all of its options available as we seek to locate additional land south of Lake Okeechobee for water storage.
Opponents of Negron's plan attack it on several fronts: scientific necessity, hydrological reality, and economic costs. They argue water storage is best placed north of Lake Okeechobee, not south, because, they say, storing water south does not eliminate the possibility of massive water discharges from the lake in times of high water. They contend it doesn't clean harmful nutrients from the lake, and that purposefully flooding thousands of acres of productive agricultural land will cost jobs. But Negron is pushing forward.
There is a reasonable disagreement about when we need it and where it should go. I keep hearing people talk about let's do something in 2021 or 2025. That's not acceptable to me or my community or to Southwest Florida. You know, we're not just going to study things and wait and expect people to endure this havoc wreaked on their communities. So I'm not going to be waiting until 2021 or 2025. And secondly, as I said from day one, I'm open to places that we should have a reservoir, and we're looking at different options.
In making his case, Negron points to a Florida law he had a role in writing. Last year, lawmakers passed and Governor Rick Scott signed the Legacy Florida Act. It earmarks state money for Everglades restoration. The money comes from Amendment 1, the constitutional guarantee approved by voters to spend more on protecting and repairing the environment.
I had a hand in writing it. It says, priority shall be given, not may be given, not should be, priority shall be given to projects that reduce the need for discharges east and west of Lake Okeechobee.
That law from last year puts $200 million a year towards Everglades restoration. This year, Negron's reservoir plan would use $100 million of Amendment 1 funds each year over the next two decades to buy and build water storage. It would raise the money next year by issuing bonds.
When there's a front page article on the national section of the New York Times showing our community floating with green algae, people don't say, oh, I shouldn't go to the general area between Vero Beach and West Palm Beach, and I shouldn't go to Sanibel or Fort Myers. They go, oh, I didn't know they were polluting their water in Florida.
When Negron talks about his desire to buy more land and build a reservoir, he knows it'll impact lives and businesses south of the lake in the agricultural communities of Palm Beach County especially. But he talks about shared adversity by how Florida deals with this massive ecosystem now. Between algae blooms hurting businesses on the coasts and land for water storage hurting agricultural businesses below the lake.
I understand that we have a thriving agricultural industry south of the lake. I support that agricultural industry. I'm proud of the agricultural history and tradition of Florida. It's one of our main parts of our economy. That being said, there still is a way, in my view, to have somewhere for the water to go south of the lake to be stored so that it doesn't have to go east and west. And I'm going to continue to pursue that objective.
And to that end, what plans do you have to address the concerns of Glades residents who are worried about the economic impact of the Southern Reservoir?
There has to be shared adversity. There has to be, we can't have the entire effect of this environmental disaster on communities east and west. And I, as I've said from the beginning, we can do this in a way that does not cause economic harm to our fellow citizens who live south of the lake and into our agricultural community.
That's Florida Senate President Joe Negron. Still to come, we'll hear a big voice from that agriculture community.
Investing all of your hopes and money into storage south of the lake is a fool's dream.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Kate Stein. This is the river of grass dying of thirst. 15.5 feet. That's as high as Lake Okeechobee is allowed to go before the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers opens the gates, literally, letting loose hundreds of thousands of gallons of water to the east and west of the lake.
That's what happens when the lake gets too much water too fast. Now, the Corps manages the lake level for public safety and flood control. Today, the lake is right around 12 feet. But after record rains last winter, the lake swelled to over 16 feet, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers opened the gates, increasing the water flowing to the east and west in order to bring the lake level down. By early March of last year, the lake level was back under 15 feet, but the higher discharges continued throughout the spring and early summer as the Corps worked to reduce the lake further ahead of the wet season. Then in June and July, the green, toxic, guacamole-like algae choked marinas on the East Coast and closed some beaches for days.
To hear Judy Sanchez explain it, sending that water into a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee would not have helped. I spoke with her last week on a windy day among the sugarcane fields.
Storage south of the lake would have absolutely no impact on algae. One is water quantity, the other is water quality.
Sanchez is the Senior Director of Corporate Communication and Public Affairs for U.S. Sugar. She's defended U.S. Sugar and the broader agricultural industry in and around the Everglades agricultural area for more than 20 years. She's heard all the arguments for water storage and has navigated the tense relationship between the economic interests of agriculture and restoration. I met Sanchez at U.S. Sugar's headquarters in Clewiston, then headed out for a tour of the sugarcane fields that stretch for thousands of acres below the southern rim of Lake Okeechobee.
Muck soils of the Everglades agricultural area are basically pure organic material, decayed plants over the years that have built up a wonderfully productive soil that's naturally high in phosphorus. In fact, some of our fields have anywhere from 300 to 800 parts per billion phosphorus. And that's what Mother Nature put in these soils, and that's what makes this such a productive agricultural area.
The muck is known as black gold, rich, dark soil perfect for growing sugarcane, winter vegetables, some citrus, and even some sod. On the day I visited, the skies were blue, the sun was shining, and this year's cane harvest was well underway.
Picture the juxtaposition of our rich, dark soils, the beautiful green cane that's of everywhere from just coming up out of the ground in tender sprouts to towering 12 to 15 feet tall. We also have large mechanical harvesters that are pretty much the same as combines that you might be familiar with across the Midwest. But they go through the field and they have a blade at the bottom which cuts the cane stalk at the ground level, leaves the root system in the ground, and that plant will grow back up and we'll harvest that crop again next year and the next year and the next year. We'll get an average of 4 annual harvests off of one planting of sugarcane. It's a perennial.
Perennial also describes the debate over the Everglades ecosystem, particularly now as Florida lawmakers consider the plan to buy 60,000 acres to store water. Some of that could be land owned by U.S. Sugar, but Sanchez said there's no need for it.
Storage south of the lake is part of ongoing restoration, and it's part of future projects that are already part of the planning process. But there is no need to acquire more land for that because the land has already been acquired.
She's referring to thousands of acres of land the state has bought from U.S. Sugar and others, and the planning process for water storage that's included in the original Everglades restoration project. The option for the state to buy more land from U.S. Sugar as part of a deal 10 years ago, Sanchez says, is an all-or-nothing proposition.
The only option left on the table is to purchase 153,000 acres of land. And there's no way on earth that with $5 billion of projects in the queue ahead of that, that the state and federal government would have any need for such a large amount of land. It's not contiguous, it's scattered across 3 or 4 counties, and Everglades restoration is precisely planned and engineered for projects that will provide the biggest bang for the buck for the most parts of the system. And purchasing a huge amount of land south of the lake is nowhere in any of those plans.
The agricultural industry has been aggressive in defending its practices reducing pollution and in pointing out land that has already been purchased for water storage. As our driving tour of the cane fields continued, I asked Judy Sanchez with U.S. Sugar if the company believes it plays a role in addressing water storage.
U.S. Sugar, along with all of the other sugarcane farmers and vegetable farmers in the Everglades agricultural area, have given up 120,000 acres of very productive farmland in the name of restoration. In addition, we've invested more than $400 million through Everglades Forever Act taxes on farming, through investments in research and implementing best management practices to reduce phosphorus. We are part of the most successful phase of Everglades restoration, which has been phosphorus reduction. The land that's been taken out of agriculture, part of that land that was bought in 1999 is designated as the land purchased for water storage. And the engineers have looked at various depths and various configurations of that, and that is in the plans for future water storage. They already have the land. So we support storage north, south, east, and west of the lake, but they don't need to purchase additional land south of the lake. There's a huge planning effort underway to determine the storage that's needed north of the lake, because that is where the massive volumes of water that are wreaking havoc on the estuaries are coming from. It doesn't matter what size storage you have south of the lake. Once you fill it up, because you can't send it south during those wet events to the Everglades because they're full and they're protected by federal regulation, it's going to continue to rain north of the lake, and that water is going to continue to pour into Lake Okeechobee. And where is it going to go? East and west. So investing all of your hopes and money into storage south of the lake is a fool's dream because it doesn't fix the problem. It is the tiniest, most expensive Band-Aid that you can have because it's going to be a few days worth of storage when you have months and months of discharges.
Neither northern nor southern storage can guarantee an end to the lake discharges and the algae blooms. And that gets at the heart of the debate over Everglades restoration efforts, how to minimize negative economic impacts but address increasingly urgent ecosystem problems. It's a balance Judy Sanchez of U.S. Sugar believes the agricultural industry has borne.
So for people who are saying, you know, we need to share the adversity, when it's wet everywhere, and water has an impact on our crop, drought has an impact on our crop. But giving up 120,000 acres of productive farmland has shut down sugar mills, it's shut down packing houses, and if you drive through these towns, you'll see a lot of empty storefronts and a lot of economic devastation because of lost income and lost jobs in this area. And we need to find solutions that don't trade off problems in one area for problems in another area. We need to find solutions that fix the problem. And since the source of the problem is coming in from north of the lake, it only makes sense to go and seriously build storage north of the lake. As long as you continue to only focus south of the lake, you'll never fix the estuary problems, because once that southern storage is full, no matter how big you make it, it's never going to hold several million acre feet of water, which is what was discharged from the lake in 2016.
Judy Sanchez with U.S. Sugar. The question remains, would either northern or southern storage prevent discharges of millions of gallons of water? So still to come, north versus south for storing water, protecting the environment and the economy.
We need storage north and of the lake, and we need storage south of the lake, and neither one of those is going to be the end of the problem.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson.
I'm Kate Stein. In our series, River of Grass, Dying of Thirst, we explored the central Everglades question for Florida lawmakers this legislative session, whether to pledge money to buy farmland south of Lake Okeechobee for water storage.
Okeechobee is a Native American word for big water. Now, some attribute it to the Seminoles, but the Miccosukees also lay claim to it. It isn't a very deep lake at all, but it dominates the geography of South Florida. And for what it's worth, the Tequesta word for big water lent itself to the area dominating South Florida, Miami. So perhaps all of this, Kate, is just historical fate, along with the natural hydrology, that this debate over water into and out of Lake Okeechobee would encompass north and south.
The lake hasn't flowed freely for a century, but it remains central to addressing the environmental and economic issues surrounding Everglades restoration. Here's Amy Green from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE.
Marianne Martin motors the trails carved among the grassy bulrushes rimming Lake Okeechobee, emerging on a watery expanse that ends where blue meets blue at the horizon.
This is the Big O. Isn't it beautiful? Blows your mind. You can't see hardly across the lake.
She cuts the pontoon boat's engine. In the distance, anglers fish for bass, catfish, and crappie. Cormorants and pelicans take flight from a small island, their wings beating the water's surface. For 35 years, Martin has made a living from the lake as the owner of the Roland Martin Marina and Resort on its south shore in Clewiston.
When I saw this lake, I fell in love with it. And it speaks to you. If you just sit, listen, you hear the birds. It's just amazing. It's full of life.
Focus was on Lake Okeechobee last year as its excess water inundated estuaries on Florida's east and west coasts, triggering toxic algae blooms that prompted emergency declarations in four counties. The lake serves as the liquid heart of the Everglades.
It's hard to describe how much water this is.
Audubon of Florida scientist Paul Gray says a reservoir south of the lake is aimed at restoring a more natural flow of water south in the River of Grass. That's as new research calls for much more water storage throughout the Lake Okeechobee and Everglades regions.
What if we had a landowner that had 40 square miles? He said, hey, can we put a foot of water in your land? And they said, yeah, sure, we don't care if you kill everything. How would you pump that much water in one day? That's really hard. And then you would only take care of one day out of 60 or 90 days of releases. And so these are the volumes of water that we're trying to deal with.
Historically, the lake spilled its excess water over its southern brim, creating a shallow sheet that was the Everglades. After deadly hurricanes in the 1920s and 1940s, the lake was contained within an earthen dike that today is among the nation's most urgently in need of repair.
Herbert Hoover Dike, we've said for several years now, is not a structure that we have a lot of faith in terms of being able to withstand high water levels.
John Campbell of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers stands atop the dike in Clewiston, eyeing a construction site 30 feet below. The project is part of a billion-dollar dike refurbishment scheduled to be complete in 2025.
One of the big reasons we released water is to protect the integrity of the dike. Lake Okeechobee already has a history of taking large amounts of human life.
Hurricanes in the 1920s killed thousands. As described in the Zora Neale Hurston novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. The Corps will look into storing more water in the lake as the rehabilitation nears completion. But there are ecological concerns about that, especially for the grass beds that provide important habitat for spawning fish and other species. Here's marina owner Marianne Martin, who's worried about the ecological impacts of a rising lake.
If the intent of this levee is to build it strong enough to hold 18, 19 feet lake level, you have just put a knife into this lake. Into the heart of this lake.
At a lakeside marina in Pahokee, a great blue heron squawks as it flaps into the air. Diana Jenkins reels in a crappie. It squirms on the pavement. At stake here is an economy reliant on Lake Okeechobee and the farmlands the reservoir would replace. The region is the nation's largest producer of sugarcane. But Jenkins isn't worried about that now. She fishes here nearly every day.
I love it. It's very relaxing. Just to come and sit by the water, whether you catch fish or not, it's still all right.
She plans on cooking up her catch for her family.
Water naturally runs in one direction, but the Florida effort to drain, dike, dam, and direct water created the South Florida economy out of the Everglades, including the agriculture industry. Now, supporters of the legislative proposal to buy land to store water south of the lake say it will speed up plans already in the Everglades Restoration Plan, helping restore dehydrated sawgrass in the glades and seagrass in Florida Bay. But opponents contend storing water south of Lake O is expensive. They say it doesn't address water quality concerns and limits where the water eventually goes. They argue storing water north of the lake is a better option to capture the water before it ever feeds into Lake Okeechobee on its way down the Florida Peninsula.
So, north or south water storage? Amy Green from our sister station WMFE in Orlando continues our reporting.
Among the cow pastures and citrus groves of Florida's heartland north of Lake Okeechobee, patches of wetlands like this one serve as kidneys for the Everglades.
It filters out all the impurities. In this case, we're talking about nutrients, phosphorus in particular.
Ernie Marks of the South Florida Water Management District steps through the grass, framing the expanse of reeds and rushes. The vegetation sees from the water the nutrient responsible for toxic algae blooms. Wading birds like egrets flap among the cabbage palms. Mark says more water storage is needed here north of the lake. New research suggests the river of grass historically was much wetter than previously thought and calls for additional storage throughout the Lake Okeechobee and Everglades regions.
The next natural step is to look to the north, and not only to look to the north because of the absence of storage that we currently have there, but having something to the north gives us ultimate flexibility where we send the water.
The Water District's focus here puts the state agency charged with overseeing Everglades restoration at odds with Senate President Joe Negron and environmental groups. They are fixed on a southern reservoir. After excess lake water inundated estuaries last year on Florida's east and west coasts, triggering toxic blooms that prompted emergency declarations in four counties. Both reservoirs are part of the world's largest environmental restoration of its kind, a $17 billion rehabilitation of the Everglades. But Wendy Graham of the University of Florida Water Institute says nearly 20 years after Congress approved the effort, almost no water storage has been added, and only a small amount is designed or under construction.
The problem is so big that every increment only achieves a little bit of the solution. You have to look at the system as a whole to really see the system-wide benefits. And we need storage north of the lake, and we need storage south of the lake, and neither one of those is going to be the end. of the problem.
Mark said the South Florida Water Management District says a northern reservoir could provide up to a third of the water storage needed in the Everglades. That's important because the watershed spans central and south Florida and supports the drinking water of more than a third of Floridians. Planning began last year, and the project could be ready for congressional approval as soon as 2019. But work on a southern reservoir isn't scheduled to start until 2021. Negron and environmental groups want to speed that up, but Mark says the water district must follow the schedule, unless the governor or legislature direct otherwise.
It looks at leveraging all of those benefits as we move forward through time. So if it makes sense to implement one project before another, because you can reap a certain benefit from doing so, that was what our engineers and scientists went through in developing the schedule.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it could deviate from the schedule with a state partner, like the South Florida Water Management District or another state agency. A northern reservoir is only part of an effort to add storage throughout the region. A restoration of the Kissimmee River nearly is complete. The state also is partnering with landowners like ranchers to store water on their land.
It could be a lot better?
Yes, it could.
On Lake Okeechobee's north shore, Eileen Massey eyes her fishing pole, frustrated by the rod's stillness.
It's the closest you'll ever get to Jesus. It's right here on the spear. I believe that. To me, it is. I love it. I love every minute I'm out here.
But Massey says the fish aren't biting. For 9 years, she's fished here. She remembers when the lake looked cleaner.
If we, as people, don't take care of our waterways, that when our grandchildren are old enough, if we live long enough to have grandchildren, what's going to be left for them to do? I mean, the waterways is the most important thing we got.
The fight over Florida's waterways is poised to dominate the spring legislative session. Amy Green in Orlando.
Still to come, the bitter debate in America's sweetest town, where sugar rules the economy.
The people on the coast are financially more stable, have more money to spend. You know, there have been comments that we should be lucky that they want to buy our land and flood it, since we're so economically challenged.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, the river of grass, dying of thirst. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Kate Stein. Sugar dominates the landscape and the economy in the small town south of the Herbert Hoover Dike that holds back Lake Okeechobee. It's these sugar towns and their residents who have been at the center of the bitter battle over how to manage the lake's waters and, more broadly, how to manage the Everglades ecosystem. Carson Turner talked about this recently with reporter Amy Green from our sister station in Orlando. Standing in a sugar field at the heart of his community, Turner broke open a cane stalk and explained what it represents.
This will go into the mill. You can just about see, if we take about 20 steps backwards, you can see the smokestacks. And those get grinded. That raw sucrose that gets pushed out becomes the basis of table sugar that you and I consume all the time.
The cane field stretches to the horizon, where the world's largest sugar mill billows smoke. The mill serves as the heart of U.S. Sugar Corporation. Turner has lived among these fields nearly all of his life. He's a Hendry County commissioner.
When I look at these cane fields, I think of the actual families, the people that I grew up with, their children, their grandchildren, and what they've built these farms on with sweat equity.
Sugar built these communities. In the case of the Clewiston Inn, U.S. Sugar literally built it for its guests and dignitaries. The inn is a stately two-story white building with columns out front and woodwork and murals inside. On the day I visited, the place was sleepy, no guests in sight. Valerie Jacobs was behind the front desk, an electric fan whirring beside her.
Most people have got somebody in their family that works for U.S. Sugar or who has worked for U.S. Sugar or is retired from U.S. Sugar. So it's just the way it is in Clewiston.
U.S. Sugar sold the Clewiston Inn about a decade ago. Now, the dining room is closed because of a lack of customers. Jacob says other restaurants and hotels in town are struggling, too. Having to sell land for the reservoir, she says, could make things worse.
The impact on Clewiston is if they lose the ranches and they lose U.S. Sugar property, the town will cease to exist. That's where the money is. It's in the ranches. It's in the sugar cane.
The industries that bring guests to Clewiston's restaurants and hotels. Clewiston is on the eastern edge of Hendry County, which has the highest unemployment rate in the state. Jacob says being a company town is a major disadvantage for Clewiston residents who feel their voices aren't being heard in the reservoir debate.
The people on the coast are financially more stable, have more money to spend. You know, there have been comments that we should be lucky that they want to buy our land and flood it since we're so economically challenged.
Back in the sugar fields, Sam Williams has been farming for U.S. Sugar for 28 years. He was born and raised in Clewiston, takes care of 35,000 acres on the town's west side. He works from 6 in the morning to 4:30 in the afternoon, planting, tending, and harvesting sugarcane.
My family's been raised here forever, and this is what we do for a living. It's not a short-term thing. This is what we plan on doing and being here for a while. So, you know, we stand behind U.S. Sugar and U.S. Sugar employees, and we're going to stick together and fight it.
Kate, a lot of this debate is centered certainly on environmental issues, but the economy plays a huge role in all of this. The impact that any reservoir could have on the agriculture industry, the impact of doing nothing could have on the businesses along the coastlines. I know there's been some studies that look at what the job impacts could be at the different options here. What have they shown?
Well, so the two studies that we've seen, one comes from the conservative James Madison Institute, and that study says about 4,100 jobs would be lost if the reservoir is built, the southern reservoir, that is. Mm-hmm. Mostly jobs in agriculture, those would be. That's in contrast to a second study by researchers at Clemson University, and that study was released by the Everglades Foundation. It says 39,000 jobs would be created in construction if that southern reservoir is built. And the study also says more jobs could come through increases in land values if the toxic algae is eliminated. So as the algae goes away, real estate values rise, and we get sort of a trickle-down effect with more jobs coming.
And that second study looked at jobs really just in the construction industry, and it said that a further study of other kind of ripple effect on the job market if this water storage is built is still forthcoming.
Right. The researchers say they'll be releasing another more detailed report on the longer term job gains that could come from this reservoir and potentially losses also too. They said they hadn't really looked at the potential negative impacts of taking up some of that agricultural land for water storage south of Lake O.
Some of these shortcomings of these studies, the academic studies can never really capture everything in a dynamic economy. What did they miss?
Well, for one thing, they don't look at all of the counties where the reservoir could potentially be built. I think the James Madison one focuses on Palm Beach County and Hendry County, not sure about the Everglades Foundation Clemson University study. So there's more to come in terms of research, and that would also depend on where the reservoir, if it's built, where it actually is built.
You can find all the reporting on the website, some video and pictures as well, wlrn.org/river-grass. It's wlrn.org/river-grass. For Kate Stein, I'm Tom Hudson. Wanda Miles is our technical director. Thanks again for listening today.